From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The series Touching Evil just returned to the PBS program Mystery. It's set in a British crime unit that investigates serial killers. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from the creator of Touching Evil, Paul Abbott. He also wrote for the series Reckless and Cracker. He didn't start writing about crime until he was the victim of a brutal mugging. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Holy Smoke, the new Jane Campion film starring Harvey Keitel and Kate Winslet. And TV critic David Bianculli previews The Sopranos, which begins its second season Sunday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Supreme Court will consider whether states can ban a type of late-term abortion. The court will review a Nebraska law that criminalizes the procedure. Similar laws have been passed in 30 states. The last big abortion ruling from the court came in 1992 when justices reaffirmed core abortion rights established in 1973. President Clinton says it's a good first step that the pharmaceutical industry has dropped its opposition to his administration's plan to offer a drug benefit for Medicare recipients. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Last year, the drug industry spent millions of dollars on ads opposing President Clinton's proposal to provide a prescription drug benefit as part of Medicare. Now the companies say they want to work out a compromise, and Mr. Clinton says that's a good first step.
Now what we need is positive actions from the drug company and positive action in Congress, not just on the benefit, but on the efforts to strengthen and extend the life of the Medicare Trust Fund.
The drug companies have not said, however, that they are changing their opposition to having the government buy drugs for Medicare by contracting with drug purchasing firms. The government would be such a big buyer that it would probably be able to bargain for lower prices. The drug companies say that would lead to price controls. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Late show host David Letterman is reported to be doing fine in a New York hospital today after emergency quintuple bypass surgery. The operation was scheduled after a test found one of his arteries was seriously constricted. The 52-year-old comedian had an angiogram because of what he said was high cholesterol and a history of heart disease in his family. Doctors indicated that while Letterman's arteries were clogged, his heart muscle was in excellent condition. Florida Governor Jeb Bush has signed legislation passed during a special session on the death penalty held last week in Tallahassee. Susan Gage of Florida Public Radio reports.
Governor Jeb Bush supported the legislature's efforts to pass bills making lethal injection another way to impose capital punishment and speed up the time inmates must file their appeals. State Representative Victor Crist says the legislation to reform the death penalty appeals process is a necessary step to get executions occurring faster in the state.
They can file as many frivolous lawsuits as they want for as long as they want. And that's why we have 367 inmates on death row and we're only executing two a year. So you can't get more broken than the way the system was.
Bush's signature on the lethal injection legislation means death row inmates will have to choose between dying by needle or in the state's electric chair. But critics complain the legislation doesn't specify what drugs the state will use. For NPR News, this is Susan Gage in Tallahassee.
Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 141 points to close at 11,722. Advances led declines 4-3. The Nasdaq Composite Index was up 107 points. You're listening to NPR News. Pakistan told a visiting U.S. delegation that it wants Washington's support for resolving the dispute over Kashmir. Pakistan's military rulers are under pressure from Western governments to set out a timetable for a return to democracy. Veer Singh reports.
A senior Pakistani official said the United States has the capacity to play a moderating and constructive role for ending the decades-old dispute between Pakistan and neighboring India over Kashmir. His comments came during a visit by U.S. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle and four Democratic senators who met with Pakistan's military leader, General Pervez Musharraf. They asked him to end military rule and to get Pakistan to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. India has opposed Pakistan's demands for outside intervention on Kashmir, saying both countries must resolve the dispute among themselves. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
President Clinton today announced a new plan to allow airline pilots, mechanics, and other aviation employees to report safety problems without fear of punishment. The president says tough air travel air travel is already safe, but he says the program will get the industry ahead of the curve. The program is the result of a year's negotiation with the airlines, the unions, and government regulators. The president is blaming Congress for having completely shredded the budget caps they both agreed to. His attack comes as his administration acknowledges the budget Mr. Clinton submits next month will go way over the limits. Speaking to reporters, the president insisted his budget will still be fiscally disciplined. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, exploring the mystery of the men who were lost on Everest on Nova, Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS. Local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Detectives Dave Cregan and Nicola Walker continue to track down serial killers on the series Touching Evil. This British cop series returned this week to the PBS anthology Mystery. Three cases, each two episodes long, will be shown over the next 6 weeks. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Paul Abbott, the creator of the series, who also wrote many of the earlier episodes. He previously wrote for the TV dramas Cracker and Reckless. Touching Evil is about the detectives in a new British crime unit, a rapid response team investigating serial murder and organized crime. This unit doesn't actually exist in England. It's something Abbott created for the series. Robson Green plays Detective Inspector Dave Cregan, an officer who returned to the force after he was shot in the head in the line of duty. His near-death experience left him obsessive about tracking down killers. His partner, Detective Inspector Susan Taylor, is played by Nicola Walker. In this scene, Inspector Taylor and another detective are interrogating Emerson, a serial killer who has murdered several young women in London. The murders are especially gruesome because Emerson is obsessed by the hair of his victims, so he scalps them.
Time is 9:10. President D.I. Taylor, D.C. Rivers, interviewing Brian Howard Emerson. Let's not go around the houses with this. Forensics will tie you to the other murders at the warehouse, but we know you killed them.
You know that, do you?
What we need from
you... See this? This is how much you know.
What we need from you is a signed confession to each of the murders.
Is that your natural hair colour?
Enough.
That's okay. I don't have enough respect for you to be scared.
Oh, I'd say some cheap, nasty own brand dye they make from horse bones and fat. I'd say you avoid the hairdressers, the company of women. What's not your bag? You do it yourself, and it's all over your bathroom. There's a lot of stains on your walls, Taylor.
We'd also like to ask you about some other missing women.
You think it matters how many have died? How many are still to die?
How many women have you killed?
Oh, I don't keep accounts.
But you keep their hair?
Only when it's natural. You see, it doesn't matter how many have died. All that matters is that I continue. What's the natural course of things? Like the universe expands, so must we all. And like the universe, there's a balance between us. We depend on one another to continue. The dance of the planets, infinite and immortal. Do you understand? I didn't think you would.
I spoke with the series creator Paul Abbott in 1998 when the first episodes of Touching Evil were shown in the U.S. He told me about the concept behind the series.
Touching Evil came about from a need in British television to approach the kind of cop that is a bit more Americanized, that is a bit more a sharper cop than we're used to in Britain. I mean, in terms of clean, a clean line cop, in the way that Robson Green portrays this. We've had Cracker, we've had Prime Suspect in England for quite a long time, and they were deliberately very grainy, very low-contrast visual pieces. And just because I'd worked on Cracker, I was desperate to find something that was a bit more clipped and a bit newer, and I mean visually newer, and something that was going to look fresh to the audience. That's the visual ambition of it. I think the philosophical ambition of Touching Evil was to actually find a cop who's drive comes from his history. I know they all have, but you still have to find one at the top when you sit down to write a guy who's going to carry you through 6 hours, 12 hours of television. And I toyed around with the character of Cregan for a few years in different occupations. I wanted to write about the kind of man who faces life having basically faced death at some point and what that does to you.
What does it do to him? What does it do to the character?
I don't think he's nihilistic anymore. I think he's, you know, I think cops are occupationally nihilistic. That's just my take on them. But I think Cregan opts to see a hope in life, which is kind of the opposite of what we were doing in Cracker. In Cracker, we found the character of Fitz, who was basically so psychologically twisted himself that he understood psychologically twisted people. And that was a great way to go. I was looking for something new. And Cregan understands the world because he's kind of chosen to be here. He had a near-death experience from a shootout, and he wants to understand the world better. He's genuinely more optimistic than cops generally are.
He's also more obsessive, though, and that sometimes makes him more reckless.
Yes, there's a word. I think in trying to convince himself that he's, you know, he's a man who chooses to leave his wife and family, not because he wants to abandon his wife and family, it's because he doesn't think he's the right person for them. He doesn't think, with his state of mind, that he's the right person to take that family through the next 10 years, 20 years. And the great thing about Cregan is that he forms a strong bond with the guy his wife, Kerry, has grown to know. The guy's moved in. He's a very good stepfather to the kids. And you get the sense in the series that Cregan prays that this is the case. He doesn't want a guy who's going to be worse than he was at being a father. He genuinely wants somebody to father his family better than he could. And I think that's what I mean in terms of finding hope. Having faced death, I don't think he would have done that before he'd experienced a near-death in the shootout.
Now, the main character, Detective Inspector Dave Cregan, was shot in the head. That's what he recovered from. And he has a scar over his eye to prove that. And I believe you have a very similar scar over your eye. How did you get yours?
I think mine was slightly less dramatic in that I wasn't sure it was coming. I think it's very different from the way Cregan ran his life during the shootout. But I very simply, I got mugged, but it was quite a savage mugging. One night, I'd been out to see a friend playing a band and left to get the car. When I went to get the car, there was someone sitting in it. In fact, I'd only had the car about 2 days, didn't quite recognise it as being mine and thought I must be mistaken. And in the time it took me to work all that out, his friend came from behind and I got kind of whacked with a baseball bat, whacked with a knuckle duster, and then they kind of needlessly cut me up because I was already unconscious by the time they'd done all this. And I was kind of left on the floor and bleeding. And, I mean, it's bound to have an influence on the way you kind of face writing from that point on. It's quite a terrifying experience. That took me about 2 years to get over. You know, I couldn't walk in public places very easily. I couldn't, certainly couldn't use multi-story car parks, stacker car parks. I just got very afraid to go out, and it took me about 2 years to actually reduce that victim psychology into something that I could write about. I wrote an awful lot about it, but nothing exorcised it like time did. And I eventually just kind of took to very much going in public places, very much parking up in multi-story car parks and that kind of challenging fate. And it made me artificially stronger. I knew the exercise was, it wouldn't be recommended by a shrink, but I just felt that I had to do that to put me back in the public arena.
Did you start arming yourself too? Did you carry a knife?
No. I contemplated carrying a knife, but I mean the penalties are so high. I don't think any mitigation carries in Britain for carrying a knife. So if I were to be found with that, the police wouldn't accept the fact that I'd been mugged as mitigation to carrying a weapon. It would be seen as carrying an illegal weapon and charged accordingly, which would ultimately affect whether I worked or not. So I chose not to.
Was there ever a trial? Were the people who did this to you ever found?
No, they weren't. They were, curiously, on the night, I gave a very good description of the guy who did this, because I happened to have trapped one of their legs in the car door and heard it crack, so I think I'd broken his leg. And the description I gave of his clothing, of his hair and demeanour, absolutely matched a guy they arrested that night in a casualty unit with a broken leg who was lying about his injuries. And it just wasn't the same guy. I mean, I felt very, very sorry for the guy they brought in. They virtually plastered his leg up and dragged him out to the police station where I was being taken care of, to the hospital where I was being taken care of, and made him do a lineup. And it just wasn't him. He was just a victim of his own stupidity that night.
Hmm.
And but about 6 months later, I was out shopping, kind of buying jeans, and it was a bit like a Hitchcock scene, because in the department store, I actually saw the guy who did it. But I could only see him. You know those awful ground floor of a department store is always kind of makeup and perfume.
Right.
And it's so busy and glazed and reflective. I couldn't see where he was standing. I could see the guy, and he saw me looking, and then he disappeared, and I ran. And what I ran with was what I was looking at the time. And so I was being chased by two security guys who thought I was on a shoplifting spree, and had to drop the bags at the door to stop them chasing me. And I just lost the guy. It was very haunting, because I think 6 months in, I felt like I was getting over it, and that event reminded me how embedded it was in me, because I couldn't speak for about a day. And that wasn't fear, it was anger.
How did the cops handle it? What was your satisfaction, your feelings of satisfaction or dissatisfaction with them?
Well, this happened in central Manchester, and I think the police are very busy at weekends in Manchester, and you would have expected that I'd get, you know, the most cursory attention from the cops, but they were absolutely fantastic. And there was a very young female cop inspector who was dealing with this, who just repeatedly said, and I couldn't quite understand what anybody was saying at that time, it wasn't your fault. Just remember, it wasn't your fault. They came for you. It wasn't your fault. And she kept saying, you know, you'll think after this, you've got that kind of face that people come after you. But they come after anyone. It wasn't your fault. She kept saying this. And of course, you know, for the next 2 years, that's exactly what I thought. I thought, you know, I've got the kind of face where, you know, this happens to people like me. And it never had before and never has since. But it was such an intractable mantra that came to hit me. I was so delighted she'd said that on the night, just to counterbalance the disorientation.
How did her interaction with you and the performance of other cops who you came in contact with after you were mugged affect the way you write about cops in your TV shows?
Well, to be honest, she fuels the way... She's never known this. I've never been in a position to tell her, but she actually fuels the way I write most women characters, because, you know, there's such a trend in Britain to soft soap women characters. There just was. You know, writers would always claim to be very good at writing women, but the evidence was never in their favour. And she was somebody who, she was dealing very, very casually with me and very tenderly. And at the same time, she was dealing with a violent assault perpetrated by a guy on his wife. And, you know, she dealt with him like a cop deals with a guy who's perpetrated assault. She was fantastic with him, too. She was very, very strong. And, you know, I've known strong women, but the fact that it happened that night in my life made me want to, certainly in terms of writing cops and certainly in terms of writing women, want to make life a bit more real in the work I did.
My guest is Paul Abbott, the creator of Touching Evil, which just returned to the PBS anthology series Mystery. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with Paul Abbott, creator of the British cop series Touching Evil, which just returned to PBS as part of the anthology series Mystery. You know, the main character in Touching Evil, Detective Inspector Cregan, has been, because he was shot in the head, he was close to another world. He very nearly died, and he kind of comes back from the edge, recovers, and then goes back to work with this renewed determination. Were you close to another world too after you were mugged? Did you almost go to the other side?
Not quite. I think it was a bit more sordid than that for me. I was left unconscious and bleeding in a car park that serves it's a car park near the cathedral in Manchester that serves the Royal Exchange Theatre. It's the fur coat and no knickers audience level of theatre viewing. And so I was surrounded by BMWs and Mercedes and, you know, five-star cars. And when I woke up, when I came round, I was still on the floor, but most of these cars had gone. So I'd been walked round by people who really should have done something about it. And I think that fueled... I wanted to stop believing in humanity. That sounds very dramatic, melodramatic, but that's the way it made me for 2 years. I wanted to stop believing in humanity, people doing things for other people. And I, you know, to this day, I can't imagine why they did that. But they're the kind of people who walk around anybody in the street assuming they're a tramp and assuming that they ought to walk around tramps. I don't know. It felt like another world. It was otherworldly in that I just thought, my God, this is... I can't believe anybody would do that. I can't believe anybody could be so coldly selfish as to just take care of themselves that night. When it was clear I was covered in blood. And wherever I came from, I was in trouble.
How did you regain consciousness? Did you come to on your own or did you wake up in the hospital? Who saved you?
No, in fact, I regained consciousness and realised what had happened. I realised how many people weren't there who should have been there, really, to help me. And just below the car park was a well-known cab rank, you know, a taxi rank. And I went down there to get one of the taxi drivers to get some help. And he actually zoomed up the electric window and took off. Didn't get any help. And in fact, it was two drunks coming out of a pub who called an ambulance. There are paradoxes I probably can't define in there, but that's how I came out of that event.
You know, when I was growing up, most of the kind of crime and adventure shows and movies that I watched, when there was someone in jeopardy, it was usually a beautiful young woman. And there was always this kind of sexual edge to the kidnapping and a sexual edge to her being tied up and held hostage or whatever. And I notice now that so many of the hostages and victims in a lot of programs and movies are children. And I'm wondering if what you think has shifted.
For me, creating that story was very, very simply from having two children of my own. And suddenly being completely obsessed about the fact that they were, you know, recently, thinking about that story, we'd had the Bulger kidnapping and murder, which affected the way everybody perceived their children. You know, a 2-year-old child was abducted by 10-year-old boys. You know, oh my God, it wasn't even an adult, two 10-year-old boys, and he was murdered on a railway track. And that changed the way people look after their kids in Britain. That changed the way people monitor their kids in Britain. And it changed the way I wanted to write stories. It was, crudely, I knew that, you know, people feared this more than anything. And I wanted to explore that.
I get the impression from reading about you, too, that you also know something about what it's like to be a child in the hands of someone who isn't necessarily taking very good care of you. Just to fill in the blanks here a little bit, I think you were grew up in a family of about 10 kids, mm-hmm. and your mother left home when you were really young, and your father wasn't working and also wasn't collecting any sort of unemployment insurance, which meant that there wasn't a lot of money in the house.
No, there wasn't. It was, I look back on those times and you know, you talk about these things to journalists and you wonder why you ever did. But the truth of it is that all my writing life has been influenced by all of that stuff. I think everything I write about has a piece of me in there that's formed by those events in childhood, like anyone else. But mine, it was such a protracted period of what, from the outside now, and as an adult, you're looking back, you think it was abject poverty. Of course, inside all that, you don't realise that until you get to 21 and think, "Oh my God, what was that?" You know, I can't imagine we were actually brought up that way, but we were, and we all seem to have come through it.
Paul Abbott created the British cop series Touching Evil, which just returned to PBS as part of the anthology series Mystery. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. And from Dell, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer. Counting Carbs, a book that counts carbs, fats, and proteins for people watching what they eat. Available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with writer Paul Abbott, creator of the miniseries Touching Evil. John Powers reviews Holy Smoke, the new Jane Campion film, and David Bianculli previews the new season of The Sopranos, which begins Sunday.
Got a blue moon in your eyes. So sad.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Abbott, creator of Touching Evil, the British cop series that just returned to the PBS series Mystery. Touching Evil is about the detectives in a British crime unit investigating serial murders and organized crime. In the first episode of the first season, the detectives investigated a series of kidnappings of children. When we left off, Abbott was telling us about his own childhood, growing up in a large and very poor family. His mother walked out when he was a boy. Now, I read that you had a breakdown when you were about 15, ended up in the psychiatric unit at a hospital, and that actually ended up really helping you change your life around.
Oh, God, yeah. It was... I think I went through such a black time just through being, you know, a transitional pubescent teenager and then having all this stuff, all this family stuff to contend with. You know, I felt like it was, as I'm sure all the kids in the family did, that you feel like it's your responsibility to keep things on the boil, make sure everybody's all right. And, you know, my father had left by this point, and we were being brought up by my 17-year-old sister. And it just didn't hang together. The sums didn't add up, you know. It was a desperately black time. And I think I, at the same time as that, I was starting to... I was the most academic in the family. I was the only one who kind of wanted to be a writer at that point. I wanted to be a doctor or a writer. And at that point in my life, I was doing an awful lot of writing, which was completely alien to the family. You know, we didn't read, we didn't have books. And it sounds like a Monty Python sketch, you know, just how poor can you be? But that it really is the way it was, that we there was no expectation to do anything but leave school at 15 or 16 and go out to work. And I enjoyed the difference for a while. I enjoyed, you know, the one who read a lot of books. I could read a book in a day, and I wrote short stories and kind of went to writing seminars by people like P.D. James, and it was a very odd thing for me to be doing. You know, it was a very wussy thing to want to do. My entire family were obsessed with cars.
right.
They're all car mechanics or builders now, and they just didn't understand all this. It seemed like I was deliberately... opting out to be better. I chose to be better, I think was their perception at that time. So I didn't feel like I got anywhere where I belonged. You know, I was very good at school, but I chose not to be there because it was just, there were too many people to have to explain yourself to. So I spent huge amounts of my last year at school just going off and walking, which was, you know, it wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't, you know, the solitude wasn't the bad thing. It was because the house was packed, the school was packed. You just wanted peace and quiet. And I think, you know, considering all the blackness you have in your head when you're a kind of average 13, 14, 15-year-old, mine seemed to be complicated by, you know, the kind of architecture of the family. And I think the solitude was really good for me, but, you know, if I was a shrink looking back at that, as they did, they thought that was a very desperate thing to want to do. And I do remember days I spent on my own, not doing anything, but I'd read a book and I'd swim. It was like Tom Sawyer. but that was always perceived of as a bad thing by the psychiatric assessors.
How did having a nervous breakdown end up helping you?
Well, because I lived in a place called Burnley, and, you know, it's classically health underfunded and all that. So you don't get top-notch shrinks there, but there was very... And it's very fast-track service, you know. They get you in and out in 15 minutes for these counselling sessions. And there was just the shrink there saying, you know, he was looking at the family history and saying, look, you know, it'd take you 50 years to get through all this stuff. I don't know why you don't just, you know, kind of switch off, move forward. And... you know, switch that off for a while until you're kind of ready to confront it and just keep moving forward, which is what I did. And I was separated from the family and put into foster care for the next 3 years till I was 18. And I had the time of my life, I have to say. I was quite close, you know, I was geographically close to my family. It was only about a mile away, but... you know, this was a family with wealth. They'd only got two small kids who were a doddle to look after. And you know, kind of space, a garden. And it just, I was very, very, very happy there. And I was allowed to move on because these people had kind of slightly, if not middle class, upper working class ambitions for academics and that. You know, I was allowed to pursue writing or reading or whatever I wanted to do. In fact, I think I seem to remember at that time I wanted to become a doctor again. And they were very happy to encourage that. It didn't seem alien somehow to want to aspire academically, which I never did. But, you know, I'm saying the ambition was there from them and the ambition was there from me.
So who encouraged you to write, since you were from a family in which writing was pretty foreign?
I think, you know, at school, they kind of leap on anything you want to do just to keep you there. Well, they did at the kind of school I went to. And I had a brilliant a Canadian English teacher who just loved the stuff that I wrote and put in one of the stories for a national short story competition. And I won £10. And that was, you know, £10 was a lot of money. It felt like a lot of money. But crucially, it taught me that you could earn money from writing. And that kind of clicked in when I was about 19. And I started to pursue that. And I haven't stopped since.
Did you watch a lot of TV when you were young? Did you have a TV in your house? I asked this because you're writing for TV now.
Yeah. No, we didn't. We didn't actually own one till I was about 15. We just didn't watch it. And the house, you couldn't sit in the house. It was just too packed. It was a very, very small house with, you know, usually 10 or 12 people there. And you just, more often than not, wanted to get out. You wanted the open space. And so I hadn't seen that much television. I think that's not a bad thing. I think when I got into kind of owning an apartment and buying my own television, I started to watch television with an adult eye, so I didn't feel like being ingrained by that much stuff that would steer me as a writer. I was writing short stories at that point, but I'd no wish to write television. I was writing short stories and theatre, and that seemed to suit me fine. I got into television by accident by working for BBC. Radio 4 doing radio drama, and quite a few of those plays were recorded in Manchester, and it just so happens that the country's biggest soap was made in Manchester, and they called me down the road and asked if I'd like a story editor's job from the three plays they'd heard. They were quite keen, so I took that and started. I think that was officially the time when I felt like I'd become a writer because I was being paid a salary.
Mm-hmm.
I think most writers would die to be paid a salary. They just want, you know, their own prices for their own voices. But that was a very mechanical job, but it was a great start.
My guest is Paul Abbott, the creator of Touching Evil, which just returned to the PBS anthology series Mystery. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with Paul Abbott, creator of the British cop series Touching Evil, which just returned to PBS as part of the anthology series Mystery. When we spoke, he was considering working on an American TV series. I asked him about the differences between American and British cop shows.
There's definitely a difference in the way they're put together. But, you know, we sit here and watch NYPD, we watch Homicide, and, you know, they're kind of best of the exports. But those shows were usually created by people who had a very good television experience, you know, like Butchko and Tom, I've forgotten his name, the guy who created Homicide, who were renegades and well-known renegades, but they were given a break.
You know, Tom Fontana?
Tom Fontana, yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic show, Homicide. But I don't believe they'd ever commission it knowing what they were going to get. I think they, it's a bit like Cracker, it ended up on air by accident. Nobody in the commissioning territory knew quite what they were going to get, just that it would be written by Jimmy McGovern and have Robbie Coltrane in it. I think that was the prime selling point, and they were slightly mortified when they saw what was coming out. How dark it was, how strong it was. And the only thing that would shut them up was an audience of, 60%. And I feel that's what happened with NYPD. I feel that's what happened with Homicide. And you imagine when you're commissioned that they're going to want this kind of stuff from you because this is what you're writing. You know, you write Touching Evil or you write Cracker, and they're going to be looking for that kind of stuff. But I think they're slightly more scared of letting an incomer try that kind of stuff. So they usually want more straightforward format material, stronger stuff that is bound to work. And if it's bound to work, it doesn't actually have much of you in it.
You said that in Touching Evil you wanted to write a more Americanized kind of series, or at least a more Americanized kind of detective. What did you mean by more Americanized?
It's very childish of me, but of course in Britain the cops don't have guns. And there are only certain branches of the police force who would have guns, and slightly elite forces. So I went for the crisper FBI style, which isn't very common in Britain. There are only, you know, four or five units permanently supplied with arms. And I just think that you can raise the stakes on the drama when there are weapons. And I'd hate for the police to be armed in Britain in reality, but I think it actually allows you to take certain storylines further down the road if there's a confrontation with weapons involved. The truth of it is, in Britain, if a cop confronts a guy with a weapon, he has to summon people with weapons. He can't actually pull one out of his belt and start firing back. That actually takes time in drama, so I wanted to sharpen them up and make them slightly more... the reason I said American is that, that's the true distinction, the kind of... the NYPD and the Homicide, the height of the drama is just boosted by the fact that weapons are present to raise the stakes.
Now, as we talked about, you were victimized a few years ago, and that has really figured into your interest in writing about crime. But I wonder, when you're watching a TV show that you didn't have anything to do with that's about crime, like Homicide or NYPD Blue, does it make you feel uncomfortable or more vulnerable because you have been a victim, or is it easy to watch? Maybe you could just watch it as a professional writer, too.
I think Homicide and NYPD, I'm a fan, not a writer. If I want to know what the episodes were about professionally, I get the scripts. But I sit down and watch those shows, and in fact, they're designed to make you feel better, whatever you are. I think if you've been a victim, they're designed to make you feel better because you've got Sipowitz running the world for you, and they're just there to be gladiators on your behalf, so you feel more protected that people with that kind of morality, with that kind of integrity and that kind of strength are in charge.
Some people worry that crime movies and crime TV shows are, in a way, educational aids for potential criminals because it teaches them all kinds of cool ways of breaking in and new sadistic crimes they might not have thought of on their own. Do you have any concerns about that? Do you think that's a legit fear?
I don't think writers are as inventive as criminals at dealing with crime. I think they find their own way through. They don't need any help. But I think generally it's looking at the structure of preparing a crime show. Basically, it's 9/10 in favour of an optimistic morality. So if they're learning, it's like the argument about, what do people learn from... do they learn, are kids influenced negatively by these kind of shows? And I'd say, well, if they're influenced negatively, they have to be influenced positively by all the good things that you've had from Fitz, from Cregan. They are people who want to do the right thing, and that's the overriding sentiment of all cop shows, that the right thing has to be done. Even corrupt cop shows, they are designed in a way you can't get away from, clean morality has to be spelled out before you can show any negative effect. I think it's a very powerful overriding signal on any cop show.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Paul Abbott created the British cop series Touching Evil, which just returned to PBS as part of the anthology series Mystery. Our interview was recorded in 1998, when the first episodes of Touching Evil were broadcast on PBS. Abbott developed a new six-part BBC series called Clocking Off, which premieres later this month in England. The big event in American TV is the return of The Sopranos. After an eight-month hiatus, The Sopranos begins its new season Sunday on HBO. Our TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
10 years ago, another memorably original, exciting, and outrageous TV series burst out of nowhere and took America by storm. That series was Twin Peaks by David Lynch and Mark Frost. It had a terrific first season, then took off for the summer as the whole country buzzed about who killed Laura Palmer. When it returned in the fall, cranking out weekly episodes to meet the needs of ABC and the audience, the speed of production took its toll. Twin Peaks, while still fun to watch, lost its intensity and finally its direction. Writer-producer David Chase, who worked on such ambitious TV series as Northern Exposure and I'll Fly Away, hasn't let that happen with The Sopranos, his first series for cable TV. HBO has a more flexible schedule anyway. Chris Rock goes off, Dennis Miller comes on, and The Larry Sanders Show used to vanish and reappear almost at will. So when Chase finished filming the first 13 episodes of The Sopranos, that was it for a long, long time. Next week, principal photography wraps on the second season of The Sopranos, even though viewers haven't seen any of the new installments yet. That's one of the beauties of this show. Chase and company are writing it more like a miniseries than a weekly drama, and pacing themselves more like they do in England. Over there, they write a series until it's ready to go, then film it. Then, when they're good and ready, they write and film more. In the right hands, this allows for a much more polished final product. And it's obvious, based on last year's shows and the first three episodes from this new season, that The Sopranos is in the right hands. Before long, you're hanging on every word, laughing at some, gasping at others, but always paying very close attention and being rewarded for your effort. Sunday at 9, the second season finally begins, with a montage set to Frank Sinatra singing It Was a Very Good Year. It's a brilliant way to remind us not only who the characters are, but where they are in their lives, all without uttering a word. And then, before you know it, we're back in the thick of things, watching James Gandolfini portray New Jersey mob boss Tony Soprano. In the first episode, Tony has to confront unexpected visitors from both his professional and real families. On the mob front, he has to deal with his uncle Junior, who's in prison, a former colleague who's returned from nowhere, and his own mother, whom Tony suspects of putting out a contract on him. And at home, he's hit with the sudden return of Janice, his scheming sister, played by Ada Turturro. Their scenes together crackle with energy, because Tony's sister, like his mother, his wife, his daughter, and his female psychiatrist, knows just how to push his buttons. Tony, it's kind of obvious by now, has some serious issues dealing with women. Case in point, this early scene between Tony and his newly arrived sister.
So how are things really with Ma?
She's dead to me.
I don't want to get in your way here, Tony. I mean, you're the one who stayed, you took the brunt. Barbara and I, we're never going to forget that.
Well, you forgot it okay for about 20 years. At least Bob pitched in.
I know. I made my share of mistakes. But Ma can't stay in the hospital forever.
Let me tell you something about this stroke of hers, and I got this from a doctor. It's called a conversion reaction. It's a big opera brought on by repressed rage. It's bullshit.
Yeah, but they also said that the symptoms are the same as a stroke, so the result is the same. She cannot take care of herself.
She's on the lam in that hospital from me.
The power struggles at home, like the power struggles at work, never seem to end. Before long, Tony is back where he started, having anxiety attacks and not knowing where to turn. His psychiatrist, played by Lorraine Bracco, is in hiding and seeking therapy of her own for the way she's treating and not treating Tony. Like Tony's mom, played with devilish wit by Nancy Marchand, these early episodes have Tony's psychiatrist excluded from the central action. But you know that's only temporary. Just when you think they're out, you know they're going to pull them back in. The great news about The Sopranos is that there's no letdown as it begins this second season. The acting, writing, direction, music, all of it simmers with intelligence and energy, and occasionally boils over with an unexpected punchline, romantic clinch, or mob hit. For the next 4 months, The Sopranos is back, and it's a TV offer you really shouldn't refuse.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie Holy Smoke, starring Kate Winslet and Harvey Keitel. This is Fresh Air. Holy Smoke is a new movie starring Kate Winslet and Harvey Keitel, directed by Jane Campion. Campion, best known for her film The Piano, wrote Holy Smoke with her sister Anna. John Power says it's one of the best movies he's seen recently.
There are many good filmmakers, some great ones, and a handful who change how we see the movies and life. Jane Campion is one of that handful. She hits us with images, ideas, and emotions that we've never before seen on screen. Her work is challenging. So challenging that it often produces that quintessential American criticism. I didn't like it. Well, if likability is what you want most at the cinema, you should probably avoid Campion's new movie, Holy Smoke. It's not likable. It's merely brilliant and uncompromising. The opening hour catches you up like a whirlwind. Kate Winslet plays Ruth, an innocent Australian vacationer in India who falls under the sway of a guru named Baba. She takes on the name Nazni and begins preaching a gospel of universal love. But she quickly finds herself in a trademark Campion situation. She's a woman seeking transcendence in a world that brands her aberrant for rejecting a, quote, normal life. Her appalled family tricks her back home to the tacky Sydney suburb of Sans Souci. There she's delivered into the hands of P.J. Waters, that's Harvey Keitel, an American cult exit specialist whose all-dark outfit is pure Neil Diamond. He takes her to a shack in the outback and sets about turning Nazni back into Ruth. He'll use whatever it takes. Reason, wheedling, sexual intimacy. But Ruth's not afraid to fight back.
I don't want to disempower you.
Oh, yeah?
If you want disempowerment, you go right back to Mother India. See how they treat women there.
They're more honest.
Excuse me?
They're more honest in their hatred of women.
I don't hate women. I love ladies.
Ladies! You wouldn't know any. I bet you date little Barbie dolls, don't you? Oh, you're so brainy. You're so big.
Campion's heroines are never simple, and Ruth has the unsettling mutability of a Hindu goddess. Over the course of the movie, she seemingly embodies every emotion. Naivete, desperation, abrasiveness, taunting sexuality, and a shattering anger worth of Kali the Destroyer. To pull off such a role requires kamikaze commitment, and Winslet pushes her acting to an exalted new level. Whether Ruth's wandering naked through the barren countryside or tremulously admitting her fear of being heartless, Winslet never once does anything to curry our favor. She makes us accept Ruth for what she is, a brave, furious, often aggravating young woman who wants something more. She just doesn't know what it is. That's not true of Campion, who works with a great artist's absolutism. In Holy Smoke, she imprints her visionary style on every frame, from the exquisite palette and gorgeous camera moves of the India sequences to the primal force of the outback's blue sky and daunting barrens. Loose and freewheeling, she keeps the movie leaping between extreme moods, serving up Bollywood-style fantasies, mirthlessly broad spoofs of suburban Australia, and unexpected moments of naked emotion, as when Ruth's freaked-out mother tears through the Delhi streets, fleeing beggars. In a sense, Holy Smoke is a feminist riff on Last Tango in Paris, and from the moment Ruth and PJ start going mano a mano, we know that she's bound to turn the tables. After all, PJ is the emissary of patriarchal values, and Campion isn't about to let an absurdly macho figure like that get away unscathed. And he doesn't. Ruth actually starts deprogramming him. But once their struggle winds up in the bedroom, the movie starts to falter. Its philosophical argument about freedom and transcendence gets lost in sex. Their roles change too schematically, and by the time PJ has literally donned a red dress and put on lipstick, we can feel the Campion sisters willing the characters to do things that their psychology doesn't really justify. Which is to say that Campion hasn't yet figured out the answer to the question of how men and women ought to live together. Then again, who has? Campion matters because, like D.H. Lawrence or Doris Lessing, she's obsessed with questioning the very basis of our lives. She's exploring the radical truths of sex and power, identifying the pathologies that disfigure our psyches, and searching out values that might heal us. Such an exploration is bound to be messy and sometimes exasperating, which is why Holy Smoke is a movie of jagged edges, uneasy laughter, and risky metaphorical leaps. But it's precisely this combative audacity that marks Campion as one of the few essential artists of our time. She would rather make us think about our lives than make us like her.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From The Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler. A collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens, intimately chronicling our country's history. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air on Martin Luther King Day, we hear from Aretha Franklin, whose hits resonated with the civil rights movement. Join us for the next Fresh Air. You better think.